And, okay, so good morning, Bruce. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Rising Sun. And the sun is rising this morning over snow in Pueblo. So finally winter arrives after spring, after the first day of spring. That's Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. I've been looking at the weather map, and it looks like a dusting of the white powdery stuff from the sky again, huh?
Yep. So good morning, and what are you up to this morning, Bruce? What do you got in your mind?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's plenty of things to talk about, but I always find those FAQs, just going through them one at a time, really helpful. Do you want to just dive into a few more of those?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Where I'm at in my sequential journey through them for the first time, which I've been doing for well over a year now, because there's a lot of them, is number 1103. And there's two or three short ones on that page, which is, let's see if I can. It's facimoutreach.org/QA/questions/questions229.htm, if you want to go there directly and follow along with what Lynn and I are reading. And these are from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles in Temecula, California, and they are all wonderful. I'm in the Will Rogers School of facim.org content. I never met a sentence I didn't like there. It's all just, it's all wheat, no chaff, as far as I can tell.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
So where are we looking today? Which one are we looking at?
1103.
Have you got 1103? And what year was that?
That was in, let me back up to my index page, 2007.
Okay. No, why do they have it listed by year?
I think because these were chronological, and they were posted, you know, about a few every week for a number of years. So they're chronological and numerical. Yeah. There's also an alphabetic index. Did you find it?
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Yeah, they're just so right on. So I don't have any qualms at all about just, you know, picking up the next one, or one at random for that matter, but I'm going through them anyway, so why not? We can all share it together since minds are joined, huh? Ideas don't lose their source.
In the room.
Okay.
Posting in the room the link so people can go there. And so you want to start reading or?
Sure. Yeah, you betcha. This is question number 1103. And it says, if it only takes one mind to see the truth, to see another's needs is important/more important than one's own to heal the entire sonship, why isn't Jesus' obvious success in this area enough to bring us all home?
Why
can't we just ride on those coattails, right? He speaks of himself as our older brother. Yet the fact that his success didn't heal the sonship seems to say that he is not truly the only someone who is among the illusory, quote, separated, unquote, must be the one who sees himself as healed to initiate the atonement. Oh, that only someone who is among the illusory separated must be the one who sees himself as healed to initiate the atonement. So there's the question.
Okay, I think I'm going to post that question in the room because it is a kind of little convoluted.
It is.
In the way that it's worded. But basically the question is, if it only takes one and Jesus did it, why aren't we all healed? And, it's funny because as I go along, excuse me, in this course, I see the truth so much of what Jesus says that yes, you are all healed.
Mm-hmm.
You are all healed. You just don't know it. And because we don't know it, we aren't acknowledging it, because we haven't had that recognition, then, you know, we continue to believe that we're here. So, but that's my thoughts, and we'll see what they have to say about it.
That's the dream metaphor. And the other metaphor that came to mind as you were saying that, Lynn, was, which is a great one. The movie metaphor came to mind, and it's like dream, it's like movie characters on the screen asking themselves, well, when will this film be over? You know.
Exactly.
But realizing that they're actually actors in a movie, asking themselves, okay, when's this movie going to be over? Well, and the can is sitting in the theater on the shelf in the projection room. It's already been played. All the movies have been screened, and the theater is closed. Everyone else is outside enjoying the sunshine, and the theater is basically a museum now, you know. But we keep asking the question, well, when's this movie going to be over? Well, and that movie theater and everything in it was part of the dream, you know, to mix metaphors. How's that?
Exactly. Well, yeah, it's all part of the furniture. Everything is part of the scenery of the movie.
Yeah.
And it really is that, you know, where am I seeing from? Where am I looking from? That either I'm looking from the viewpoint of the character in which everything seems so perfect and real, and not, there seem to be no glitches, or I look from the observer's side looking, you know, sitting with Jesus going, wow, not only did I make the movie up, I made the theater up, and I made you up sitting next to me. Wow. That is a pretty, pretty good story I made up here.
And they're all variations on how did the impossible occur, aren't they? I mean, because that's ultimately what every single question from within the dream resolves to at some point, huh?
Exactly. Because that's the ego. It's just saying, well, how do you explain me then?
Right.
How do you explain me then? You know,
interestingly enough, D. Patrick Miller, who was the first publisher of Gary Renard's book, Disappearance of the Universe, has from one of his Facebook posts, been meeting with one of my favorite, if not the favorite, teacher I had at UC Davis when I was at University of California, Davis years ago as an undergraduate. And this is a psychology professor named Charles Tart, who's actually the gentleman who coined the phrase altered states of consciousness. And he wrote this massive book, and I attended his class on that subject that he was obviously the authoritative go-to person for, along with a graduate seminar in Gurdjieff and another transpersonal psychology class and just wonderful classes. Anyway, come to find out years later, just not too long ago, that Charles Tart was a student of A Course in Miracles. Surprise, surprise. And he's been meeting with Patrick Miller for, I guess, many years, for about every 2 or 3 months for lunch. And so he's kind of saying, gee, I probably met with him 100 times or 400 times or something like this anyway. And so I guess he's encouraged him to do an autobiography, a memoir. So I'm eager to read that when it comes out. But one of the things that he drew on the class board, Charles Tart, in one of his classes, that I thought was particularly a great metaphor for how did the impossible occur, you know, and trying to measure illusion with illusion, is he says, well, let's draw a slightly curved line on the chalkboard. And then to prove that it's straight, we'll draw a curved ruler. But we won't call it either of those curved. We'll say, see, there's a straight ruler and a straight line. And I hold this straight ruler up to the straight line, and that proves that it's straight, right? But they're both curved.
Exactly.
And it's obvious for someone objectively, you know, looking at it to see that. But we, you know, from within the dream, the distortion is not evident, you know, like you were saying earlier, Lynn, everything seems completely real and consistent within the dream because the ego made this flawless hologram. And so we don't question it, except for the fact that, oh yeah, this does happen to be a nightmarish dream that has episodes that are, you know, fun or at least euphoric anyway. But they're over pretty fast, and there's a lot of drudgery and a lot of lot of stuff that isn't so great. And oh yeah, but when you start looking at the seamy underbelly of the dream, it's kind of like, oh, this is actually pretty awful.
Exactly. And, hey, I need to go and let my dog out. I'm going to mute my mic so you don't hear that. But
okay.
Keep going.
I'll carry on with a little monologue while you're doing that. Okay. So anyway, one of the things that this reminds me of is for the last, several months now, I have had a limited repertoire on my iPhone music selection because I'm wanting to not lose a bunch of other audios. Anyway, it's probably just I need to figure out how to do it. But anyway, there's a commentary from Ken Wapnick on Lesson 182 on it, and I've listened to it quite a few times now. And it sinks in a little deeper each time, along with a couple of nice Beethoven pieces, late quartets. And anyway, in this Ken's commentary on Lesson 182, he says, the idea isn't to have us suffer more. The idea is for us to recognize how much we've already been suffering and not deny it anymore. And given that recognition, we will want to practice his course. We will actually want to more than just crack the book. We will want to become practitioners of the forgiveness classroom exercises and really be more mindful and lucid and aware of when we are investing in ego's identity scam, which ties into another thing that I just crossed my email this morning. Is apparently one of my credit cards is being updated. I made a few transactions online, and I guess one of them must have been with something. All three of them were Las Vegas in relation to the conference I'm going there in a couple of weeks, where Lynn will be at the ACM conference, and probably some of you listening might be there too, hopefully. And please say hi if you do, if you are going to be there. But anyway, maybe the shuttle service, I don't know, but something must have flagged my credit card company to say, hey, we're going to send you a new card, so I guess I'll be getting a new card in a few days.
Oh, but that's possible.
But that's all part of the whole identity theft metaphor. So when I got that email, I just had a little momentary inner chuckle. It's like, oh yeah, identity theft. Why not make mental reminders or mnemonic devices so that when things happen, instead of making them an upset, make them a reminder for choosing peace instead of this. And so I was doing that. I was saying, oh, well, there's an identity theft, averted. Great. Thank you, credit card company, for doing that, for bogus charges got put on there. But anyway, the identity theft really is just basically ego saying, I'm real and you're not, you being the decision-making mind. And so, like Ken says, the whole purpose of the ego strategy is to keep us mindless and stay away from that room that where's that switch, the master switch. You can go into any other room that's got switches that choose among illusions, and boy, I'll wholeheartedly endorse that, says ego, right? But don't go in that. Don't pull the curtain back, Toto. Don't see where the real action's coming from, right? And but that's just it. I mean, we have all these opportunities to. Moment to moment to use any mnemonic device you want. I'll just wrap up with one more quick one. This morning I was somehow looking at acronyms for, or actually I was looking at ways of describing this oneness that we all are and have and that's our true nature. And a phrase that came into my head. Perfect, all-encompassing spirit, P-A-E-S. And then I realized, oh, that's the last name of a lady who you might know, Lynn, Lillian Pais, who is the translator of the Portuguese edition of A Course in Miracles.
I don't know her.
Yeah, I've met her several times at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center in Denver, Colorado. And anyway, she attends a lot of the meetings there, and just a real sweet lady, and she happens to be one of the people who translated A Course in Miracles into other language, in this case Portuguese. So I'll have to next time I see her or connect with her, let her know that acronym. But why not make acronyms, and anything that can be a trigger or a reminder for that decision-making mind to say, oh, that's right, I can choose this. And so all they are is really, you know, as the Course says, giving form to our the mind's decision to want to wake up. And so all anything that we can use as a reminder, why not? You know, and just what we're doing right now, this every Saturday morning when I get on the on Skype with you and have this conversation, Lynn, this is a reminder. It's like, oh, yeah, I could choose peace instead of this. I'm never upset for the reason I think. So, anyway.
So say that again. Perfect, all-encompassing.
Right. Yeah.
Well, okay. What is the acronym again?
Perfect, all-encompassing spirit. Yeah.
Spirit. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right.
I just thought that was a pretty good acronym, you know. It's like,
yeah, peace.
I was thinking, yeah. And it kind of spells peace, right? But pies. Anyway, should we get back to the question and answer?
Oh, sure. And so many great. I'll read the question again.
Yeah.
And then I'll go ahead to start up with the answer. So the question: if it only takes one mind to see the truth, to see another's needs as important or more important than one's own to heal the entire sonship, why isn't Jesus's obvious success in this area enough to bring us all home? He speaks of himself as our older brother, yet the fact that his success didn't heal the sonship seems to say that he is not truly, that only someone who is among the illusory, quote-unquote, separated, must be the one who sees himself as healed to initiate the atonement. So the question basically is, you know, if Jesus was so hot, how come we're not all free? You know, which, you know, that is a kind of a disrespectful question there. But nonetheless, you know, the kind of questions that get asked when we don't understand what is really happening here. So, in the first line is exactly what, you know, exactly what comes to mind immediately when you hear this. Good morning, Jim Dunn, who just came in the room. When you hear this, the sonship is healed. It's done. Mm-hmm. In fact, healing was never truly needed. In the workbook, Jesus clarifies this for us. He says, just as forgiveness overlooks all sins that never were accomplished, healing but removes illusions that have not occurred. It's the whole thing is, you know, it never happened, it never happened, it never happened, it never happened.
we're here to deny the denial of truth, huh?
Exactly.
It's a course in not know, as Ken says. Yeah.
Exactly. So healing is thus understood as a process of removing the blocks to the awareness of what has never changed. And there's a reference to the text.
Introduction, yeah.
Introduction. Okay, uh-huh. All right. It is the acceptance of what is true and the denial of what is not. Since everyone has a right mind where the reflection of changeless truth abides, and Jesus is a symbol of the right mind, his healing is everyone's. And actually, just to stop right there, Jesus is actually a symbolic character. Jesus is not even a real person who ever...
Neither are we.
Don't get too spooked by this, but neither are we.
We are not either. Exactly. So all, you know, what we're doing is we're making an allegory and a story with characters in it to give us a hint as to what's going on, because the ego only knows language. The ego does not know truth. And so in order to even symbolize truth to the ego, you have to do it in a language, and the language is, you know, absolutely made to be flawed in a way that you will never be able to know the truth from the language. So you know, get over the fact that, you know, these are words and they're telling you that something that seems so obviously here is not, because, you know, that's how bizarre we are.
I was just going to say that this is a perfect opportunity to, you know, remind ourselves as well as whoever else might be listening is that this isn't a course that suggests that we deny our experience. In fact, it suggests that we use our experience as figures in the world to become more mindful and use that as our classroom and use everything as an opportunity to forgive the decision-making mind, the dreaming mind that chose only in fantasy to believe that such a world is possible. So, but we need that in order to wake up. Without that, we would have no way of getting back to the reality of what we are as one being, because we need the duplicity in order to get back to the oneness. Not that the duplicity is, you know, the dualistic dream is real, but because we've invested in it, that is the string into the cave that we can, instead of having the dark thread into the depths of despair, we just, you know, hey, Holy Spirit says, hey, you could take that same thread, that same string, and, you know, flip your hand around and use it to pull yourself out of the cavern, out of the labyrinth, and it becomes a golden thread that leads us home rather than the dark thread that leads us deeper into despair. But it's the same information, the same photons hitting our retinas, the same sound waves hitting our eardrums, the same sensory data from our senses of touch and taste and smell and everything else that seem to be so real, but we can use that entire all those spectra of data to use as a classroom for forgiveness and for getting us out of Dreamsville.
Exactly. Well, and that's what it's made for. You're right, because you can unravel what was made or what we think was made by teasing out, just like you would unravel if you pulled the string on a sweater the way they used to make them, and you just kept pulling, you would unravel the entire sweater eventually.
Right.
A pile of yarn. You'd be back to the state, you know, that it was before you made it into all this convoluted stuff. And that's all we're doing, is just pulling the thread. And as each link comes out, you're looking and going, oh, well, that was, I get that. Oh, that wasn't real. Oh, you know, that was a serious perception on my part that, you know, almost led to some terrible disaster. You know, you just how you made it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And looking at how you made it all and the thing that actually ties it all together are the words. And that's why language is so much a part of the ego thought system. I mean, it is the epitome of the ego thought system, because it names everything.
Exactly.
And as everything named, that's what, you know, makes it all separate to us. That's
right.
how everything appears to be separate. So
right in the beginning of Genesis, you know, we had to name all the heavens and the earth, and, you know, make as many divisions and dualistic distinctions as possible, and, you know, separate all the animals and the flora and the fauna and the Linnaean system of classification. You know, it's like, not that that's not useful in some ways, but we need to, you know, do what seems to work in the world while not investing our identity in it. And that's the trick, is using those mnemonic devices and language, including language, whether it's an acronym like GIST, which is one of my favorite, which is guilt, individuality, space, time. If any of those things are invested in my identity, then I'm barking up ego's tree again, or one of its many branches. But why not use all the things of the world as reminders to, you know, get ourselves out of the dark cave of ego's labyrinth, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And so, yeah, this is, you know, that's why we have A Course in Miracles.
Yeah.
So, let's see. So he says, we're talking, if, Phil just came in the room, so I just want to say we're in the frequently asked questions in I'm going to just put the link again in the room. We're at question number 1103, and it's a question that's asking if Jesus accomplished the atonement for us all, if Jesus was really did what, you know, what we think he did, and it's, and if it says that only one needs to do it, then why aren't we all awake? Why aren't
we all, am I still here?
Why am I still here? You know, if Jesus did, why am I still here? And, you know, and again, the simple answer is, if I think there's a difference between me and Jesus, that's why I'm still here. You know,
right. Exactly. Or between my quote self, unquote, and any other quote self, unquote. Yeah, that's it, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's this belief in differences and separation that I just continue to foster through my, actually inattention to the reality. And what I've been seeing for myself is that when I question what it is that I'm seeing, deeply question what it is that I'm seeing, mm-hmm. and begin to see that, you know, it is, I mean, there's layers upon layers upon layers upon layers of what you could term being reality that I have absolutely no knowledge of. It's, you know, all the things that we think are making up this illusion, there's no way that I personally as an individual could even begin to perceive what all that is. But the fact is that it's an illusion. I don't need to perceive it. I don't need quantum physics. I don't need to know how the illusion works. Mm-hmm. I just need to know it's an illusion and stop believing in it.
Exactly.
Stop being fascinated by the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
You know,
that, yeah.
So that's kind of what we do. Healing is understood as a process for removing the blocks to the awareness of what has never changed. It is the acceptance of what is true and the denial of what is not. Since everyone has a right mind where the reflection of changeless truth abides, and Jesus is a symbol of the right mind, his healing is everyone's. Healing simply means choosing the right mind. Choosing against the right mind by choosing the ego does not void the truth, nor abolish the memory of love's presence. It merely draws a veil over them. The veil is lifted and healed is the veil is lifted and healing is accepted by, and that's important, the healing is accepted
mm-hmm.
by the mind's choice that it be so. That is all. Thus, Jesus didn't really do anything, nor could he. He is neither a success nor a failure. Of course, miracles does not view time linearly, nor does it teach the accomplishment of a historical Jesus who attained salvation and redeemed the world, as does Christianity. He is the name given to a symbolic figure who represents the right mind of the sonship. He has what we all have, as he himself tells us. The only difference between us is that he has nothing else. I think this is one of the most, to me, the most beautiful, beautiful statements in this entire course. It's from text chapter 11. It says, there is nothing about me that you cannot attain. I have nothing that does not come from God. The difference between us now is that I have nothing else. This leaves me in a state which is only potential in you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's basically it. You know,
Go
ahead.
Oh, I would say even in the Christian Bible, they forgot to leave out, you know, a hint of that too, because, you know, something, if I remember right, or something, there's a quote of, these things I do, you too shall do, and greater, something like that. Anyway, it was, that's the kind of my thinking that was conveyed even then, and as much as it was, you know, religions have attempted to distort and dissect and discard and otherwise convolute, you know, a lot of the ideas that were shared. A lot of it somehow managed to get through, you know, and at least in little bits and pieces here and there. And I think seemed like that was one of them where the idea behind it pretty much came through, is that, you know, there's no difference here. There's no, if we think that separate interests are going to do it for us, you know, that's not going to happen. And I think that even in, you know, those kind of religious documents where it's obvious that so much has been added and subtracted and distorted, there's that spirit of that does, you know, emerge here and there. And I think that's what has led, you know, us to continue to go deeper and find, you know, things that reflect our mind's decision to find that greater inclusion and the greater ones. Another thing you said a moment or two ago, Lynn, that I thought was interesting was in the previous bit you read, it kind of was talking about the ego's, you know, fantasy vision of superheroes vanquishing foes, you know, and I think that's what the ego mind wants to do with Jesus or any other character is make them outside, make them separate, make them unattainable, and make them someone who vanquishes wrongs. Well, the whole point of the course is that wrongs didn't happen. That there's nothing, there's no foe that needs to be vanquished. There's no sword that needs to come out and you know, murder the heathen enemy, because there is none. But we've made up such a horrific tale that, you know, we think that those things are what's supposed to happen. And so when it doesn't take the form that we're expecting, we say, well, what's up with that? And I think this question is kind of along those lines, is we think that, you know, there's still a tragedy screening in the theater of our mind. It's like, well, when's the guy on the white horse going to come in and save the day? Well, A, it's a movie, and B, the saving already happened because it's a movie.
Done.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's, again, you know, gives me such a feeling of confidence to know that that's true. And, mm-hmm. and I do know that that's true. And it's, you know, once I got the concept of it, I knew that I had known my whole life that it was true. I've always had this total confidence that, everything is, you know, God's in control. Everything is perfect. Nothing is going wrong. And, if I think something's going wrong, that's my own perception. I've always had that belief mm-hmm. because, and how that's been so helpful to me is that, you know, people have always called me, you know, Miss Pollyanna and, Mary Sunshine. And I mean, people used to get really irritated with me. And this was long before I knew the course, because I just had such confidence that everything was just happening the perfect way. I just knew it. Uh-huh. And so what Jesus is telling us here is, you know, it's a done deal. There's nothing really happening. Nothing has happened. And all you need to do is be aware of that, and that will bring you peace. That will yeah. bring you joy, just to be aware of the fact that, you know, the film's in the can, that, you know, the deed is done, it's all over with, and everybody lives happily ever after. What a joyful, how dare you be so happy. Yeah, people get mad with you when you were happy. It really irritates people, and I think it's because, you know, they want you to be in misery with them. That's how ego, misery loves company.
The you know, unmitigated gall, then, of you being so happy. How dare you?
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just going to reiterate what I was sharing, I think, when you went out to attend something a while ago, is that in one of Ken's audios, he says, you know, that Ken Wapnick's commentaries on the workbook lessons, he was sharing how, you know, it's not, the whole idea is not to have us suffer more, it's to help us recognize that is the nature of investing in ego's thought system, is suffering. And we cover it over, and we do all the make nice things, and the, so the fake Pollyanna approach is the bliss and any denial, you know, which sometimes takes the form of, oh, everything's great here. This is a perfect world, and I'm so happy. But if we look at when we're invested in our own agendas and our own striving to you know, get around in this world as a dream figure, you know, it, sometimes we have nice experiences, and some people have lives that seem to go along great. And I think that's where so much of that wisdom in the real alternative section of chapter 31 come to the fore, when everything seems to be going great for, you know, weeks, months, years, decades even, and then suddenly, whoops, uh-oh, what about this? And then you realize, wait a minute, this is just a little finite, you know, package that I'm hanging out in that has a shelf life of, you know, maybe a century if I take good care of it, give or take a decade or two. And it was like, well, why would I invest in that identity? You know, the ego's poster child being the body, and but its thought system being, this is a separate thing, a separate person, a separate identity. And so the transpersonal is really the way out, which is reflected so beautifully in those first three lines that are then echoed in over 1,300 pages, you know, in countless different ways. But it's, you know, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. And I think the wisdom of what Helen channeled, you know, that came forth with such clarity in those first three lines is just so profound, because it really, I think, how can anyone in the right mind read those three lines and not say, oh my gosh, that's it, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what got me. That was exactly what got me about the Course. When I read that, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies the peace of God, I knew it was true. Absolutely, it was true. Immediately. Because, you know, I spent for years and years before that, I was a Buddhist. And, uh-huh. and being a Buddhist, it's a different kind of a way of thinking. Because you still get involved in the world with, because you're still looking at suffering and experiencing suffering, and, there's a way too much emphasis in Buddhism on suffering as far as I'm concerned. Because that was the answer to the suffering right there.
Uh-huh.
And every time I would come up, I would say, you know, well, yeah, but you know, if this is not real, then that suffering is, you know, just a part of the story, and people would just be like appalled. Oh no, you must do something to help this. You must meditate to alleviate the suffering in the world. You must, you know, do good works to alleviate the suffering of the world. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on that. And what I could see very clearly was, no, all you have to do is stop suffering. And that alleviates the suffering. It's a choice. Right. Suffering is a choice. And so, you know, that when I read that in The Course in Miracles, I was like, oh, boom, this is it. This is why none of this other stuff really, as much as I love it, and now I go back and look at it, and I can see it from the viewpoint of A Course in Miracles, it fits perfectly. But it's, again, it's perceptual. And anyway, let's continue on here. I'll finish reading this paragraph and let's see. So what we have, what we have that blocks healing from awareness is the belief that that illusion is true. Mm-hmm. The desire that some form of specialness replace the oneness the Son shares with the Father keeps the insanity of the ego thought system alive and sick, quote unquote sick. Before I even go on here, this is the arrogance of the ego that is so clear when you look at it from this point of view. If you look at it from the ego's point of view, that's just the way it is, and it makes sense. And but that's how arrogant the ego is, that that you know, or honestly thinks that that specialness is important, is necessary, and is, you know, even to the point of even Course in Miracles students arguing over the possibility that there's an individual soul who has an individual identity that is acknowledged by God. Which, believe it or not, there's a whole sect, if you want to call it, of A Course in Miracles students.
No, who, Mr. Bill!
Have that belief. And are adamant about, you know, that people are being mistaken when we think that that's not true. You know, that's the specialness of the ego, and that's why just a little side note, that's why there's such a big controversy over the changing of the word soul to spirit in the Course, because to many people, the word soul does designate that special individual personality being that is me.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point with that, Lynn, because I think the whole strategy of the ego is figure out a way, no matter how challenging, to maintain a separate identity, because that is the last little shred of the fraudulent identity, the identity theft, if you will, that ego wants to maintain at all costs. And so when we get to the last bastion, we go past the space-time individuality thing to the guilt in the mind, and the individuality is really, you know, right at the threshold of that unconscious guilt, which is the, I think, Ken Wapnick points it out really nicely, is that, you know, since you were talking about Buddhism a few moments ago, that the tremendous contribution that you know, that Buddhism and other Eastern systems and philosophies and religions have contributed to that awareness. What A Course in Miracles adds to it is, as he says, you know, the purposive nature of it, which is, you know, why would we have made up the illusion? Because, you know, the Eastern modalities, you know, and I have not really studied in any great depth, but what little I understand of them is that, you know, they do address the idea that this world is an illusion in you know, significant measure. But what's not generally addressed, maybe in some of the more esoteric forms like Advaita Vedanta perhaps, which also I have not studied, but I know of, and it's supposed to be sort of like an Eastern non-dual teaching. The idea, though, is that if what the Course adds to it in its unique way, not making it special, but just you know, adding in a way that a lot of other approaches don't, is that the world is, and everything in it, including our bodies and our seemingly individual identities, is purposive, and the purpose of it is that we believe that we shattered perfect oneness, and the we again is a linguistic metaphor for the one Son of God that we all are, seemingly as separate awarenesses, that believes that somehow we pulled off this cosmic crime, and because we're not even aware of the depths of that angst and that grief over that, of thinking that we threw God under the bus, we've made up a whole universe. I mean, imagine the lengths of desperation that we've gone to in order to contrive such an elaborate hoax to keep us mindless. But that's, if the Course is right, and Ken's brilliant commentary on it, you know, I think it points that out so clearly, is that's how we can undo it. That's the beauty, the humorous part of it. I was talking to three of us last night, got together for dinner, and we're talking about life stuff and particularly in relationships and specialness, and we're just talking about how, you know, we take our, you know, certainly careers and our bodies, and we take all this stuff so seriously. But if we can just remember to gently laugh, and it doesn't have to manifest as a physical laugh necessarily, but sometimes it does, at the folly of our ego strategy to get us so invested in those things. And just, if we can just kind of ease up on that a little bit now and then, we'll see the humor in it. And so I was saying that, you know, if we read A Course in Miracles with that in mind, you can kind of, you know, now and then hear Jesus laughing hysterically at how the lengths that we've gone to make up this psychodrama and project it out, and, you know, award-winning holographic production values, and wow, what a What a trip. What a strange trip this has been.
It is. I know Jesus laughs. Because, yes, you can tell when you're reading along and some of the things that he says, when you're reading the course, you're like, oh, my God, he is laughing his butt off of that.
Exactly.
Not at us, but at just at the predicament, at the belief, the thought. You know,
with us.
It's like, you know, it's like a... there's so many metaphors for it out there in the world, like, you know, I love Lucy, you know, at the chocolate factory or something. It's like, we set ourselves up and, you know, we say, oh, we're going to be, you know, here in the chocolate factory. And everybody's like, oh, how wonderful to be working in the chocolate factory. And then, you know, there's just more and more and more chocolates, more chocolates, more chocolates. You can't take care of them, and they're falling all over the floor, and you're rushing around, and you're stuffing them in your mouth, and you're doing everything you can to, you know, try to make sense of it, when really all you have to do is just shut off the conveyor belt. But that's what we are, and Jesus, I know he laughs, you know, when he sees the convoluted situations that we get ourselves caught up in, mm-hmm. in this believing that we are this physical body that is so small and weak and frail and needs so much protection, and it's just hilarious, because that is absolutely the opposite of what we are.
Yes.
We're huge and large and strong and powerful and beautiful, and you know, we're beyond any, you can't measure what we are. You couldn't put what we are in this body. You couldn't put what we are in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
This universe is tiny. It's nothing compared to the reality of what we are. And
exactly.
yet, you know, try to cram ourselves into it and say, oh, look, you're, you know, I'm just so small and weak and, poor me.
Yeah, that's a great clip. I just Googled Lucy conveyor belt and found the video. So I'm gonna post that on ACIM blog when you send me the recording link, and I'll use that graphic for the face or the blog post. And so that because that really that's a great metaphor too, isn't it? Of the special love, special hate. Is we. First, we think, oh, I gotta surround myself with more things that make me happy. You know, in this case, it's the candy and coming down the conveyor belt, and yet, you know, when we realize that it's not exactly as wonderful as we thought it was going to be, is when we can't keep up with, you know, whatever it is. And sometimes it seems to be things we like, and other times it's things we don't like. But, you know, we stuff our face with things and realize, oh, that wasn't such a wonderful experience after all. But it all comes back to the choice in the mind, doesn't it?
Exactly. And that's it. It all comes down to what is it that I really think I am. That's why knowing myself, knowing what I am, is the key question here. You know, if I don't know myself, if I don't know what I am, I'm going to continue to believe that I'm the victim of the chocolate. And instead of being able to, you know, love the chocolate and enjoy the chocolate and laugh at the situation and have fun, I'm going to be miserable and think that, you know, that I'm going to die. Terrible things are going to happen. So I'm going to finish this paragraph. So Jesus seems like a failure as long as the mind chooses to turn away from the sanity of truth. While healing occurs when the mind decides to accept, even partially, that what it sees in the nightmare of separation is not true. In that instant, the mind shares in Jesus' healing. So even that partial, which is that little willingness, which is, you know, just saying, you know, no matter what it is, I want to see the truth. The last unanswered question, do I want to see what I denied because it was the truth? You know, he's pointing it to us all the way that, you know, once we accept that it's possible that the reality that we see is not real, once we accept that it's possible that the truth as we know it is not real, and that there's something else here that is far beyond what our logical ego mind tells us, once we accept that and are willing to, and open to the possibility, healing has occurred. Mm-hmm. It's done. All yep. now we have to do is see the result of it. And the result of it comes one bit at a time, one bit at a time. Just like healing, you know, the you know, anything. You don't see the full results of it until it has completely taken away every false thing from your life. And it's, you're only seeing the truth. It's being replaced with only the truth. That's why we do the workbook lessons. That's why we study the text. This is why we practice, because we want to see what we denied because it was the truth. We want to see the truth. And, you know, the only way to move the veil is to, you know, one stitch at a time, you can unravel that veil. And, you know, eventually you just rip the whole thing off. You're like, heck with that.
Right. Or in the case of Lucy and Ethel, just one candy at a time coming down the conveyor belt of the mind. You know, we just laugh at the idea that was going to make us happy, you know. And we leave the candy factory eventually. You know, we leave ego's, you know, fraudulent Oompa Loompa land and Willy Wonka and whatever else, you know, we thought was going to be the wonder of all wonders, and realize, you know, if I made it up and it was based on a belief in separation, it's not going to make me happy. You know, no matter how much endorphins, you know, I cram into the pie hole, you know, kind of thing. But that's just it. Yeah. Should we read the last paragraph?
Go ahead.
Okay. Jesus gives us a very simple description of the state of mind we share with him whenever we choose to. How simple is salvation, healing, in brackets there. All it says is what was never true is not true now and never will be. The impossible has not occurred and can have no effects. And that is all. That's it. But we're never satisfied with that because we still have so much residual investment in trying to make the dream work that we immediately rush off to say, well, okay, yeah, sure, I know this is theoretically true, and yeah, I get the course and yada yada, and that I, you know, I'm saying that because I watch my mind do this every day, and we rush off and say, okay, and here's my to-do list. But the trick is, I think, to remember that we can be mindful. And I think that's why the workbook is such a great opportunity, as Ken says, to look at our resistance. Why do we forget to do the workbook lessons? Why do we forget to be mindful? It's because we're still invested in, you know, a masochistic thought system. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of the dream that we need to forgive. And it's okay to notice that and what really begins that healing process is to forgive ourselves when we catch ourselves invested in yet another episode of resistance and realize, oh, I'm trying to make the impossible a big deal again. I'm trying to make the stuff that comes out of the conveyor belt, you know, the important thing rather than my decision to go into candy making and realizing that, you know, the real nourishment isn't coming down that conveyor belt. It's in something that couldn't possibly change, even if I wanted it to. And that's the real piece, is that you know, it's inevitable that we will return to that source that we never left. The only one, in quotes, needed to see everything in the light of this true perspective is oneself. That's it. And that's the self that's at the decision-making fulcrum point in the mind that says, oh, rather than messing with that conveyor belt of, you know, endless, ceaseless things to deal with and thinking that those are the big deal, we can shift with that one, you know, swipe of the hand on the knife switch in the mind over to the thought system that says, I could see peace instead of this. I could see peace instead of this. I can see peace instead of this. Right? As each thing comes down the conveyor belt. And that is why it only takes one teacher of God to heal the world. We take a step closer to the healing we share with Jesus each time we're willing to question the ego's interpretation of any situation to prove separation is real, in parentheses. And that's what our resistance does, is it an attempt to prove that separation is real. And that's all forgivable because it didn't happen. And then we accept, and it says, and accept the Holy Spirit's perspective that separation is not real. One is true, the other is false. It is for us to choose. And again, I find it so helpful to think of kind of a visual metaphor of the ego's vast, seemingly vast realm of choices is between countless illusions, illusion A, illusion B, illusion C, and extending off in every direction and every dimension to infinity, right? And all the different things that we could do with our lives and choices we can make. But if any of those involve space or time or bodies or individuality, we're betting on the wrong horse. We're thinking that somehow making a choice among illusions is going to make us happy instead of the vertical, if you will, choice of getting above the battleground, as the Course describes it, and choosing against ego. And that's the not know of denying the denial of truth that is the real peace that we could always choose. So,
absolutely. And so, how do we do that? You know, this. You know, let's look at some simple but real in our lives kind of situations. So, for instance, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but my husband is getting laid off from his job on April 29th.
You did.
And so to look at that and think, okay, you know, that means that, you know, we got to figure out a way to get another income. You know, how much money do we need? When do we have to have things by? You know, what can we do? You know, you go into this mode immediately when you hear a thing like that because the ego says, oh, your source is being cut off. You know, the source of your livelihood is being removed from you. Now what are you going to do? And so then you conspire with ego and all of its many realms of, you know, well, I could do this, I could do this, I could, you know, let's try this, let's, you know, get into a whole mode of planning for yourself. When in reality, the healed mind says, okay. Not, you know. We'll see what happens next. You know, that's it. The healed mind doesn't plan because the healed mind knows that this is all done. It's a done deal.
Right.
There's no, you know, I don't have to do anything. Nothing is going to change the reality of anything, and nothing is going to change the story either. So in the story, he loses his job. In the story, we become destitute. In the story, we live in the gutter. In the story, I win the lottery. In the story, we move to Hawaii and have a palatial mansion. You know, I don't know what the story is. Right. Do you know what the story is? No, nobody knows what the story is. It was written long ago, and I have a feeling that it was like one of those kind of books that you see where there's choose your own adventure, you know, that, you know, eventually you can make a choice that can move you into a little bit different adventure that is less painful or less stressful than the one you've been in. I don't know. Because for me, the moving from the painful and stressful does not have anything to do with the circumstance. It only has to do with your own state of mind.
Exactly.
And so if your state of mind is peace and you're recognizing that the impossible has not occurred and can have no effects, what was not true never is and never will be, then I don't have to be in fear of what is going to happen next because it's already happened. It's done. You know, all the children went home and they lived happily ever after. That's done. And so now instead of stressing and worrying and working and straining and doing all those things, now I'm just relaxing and saying, okay, well, we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a great example, and because having been laid off many times, actually, and in different jobs, I can very much relate to that. And I think the challenge is to not go to the place in the mind that says, this situation, this circumstance is what brings me peace. And I think if we can remember to kind of back up and pause for a moment right at the onset, you know, of egos blathering on about, oh, you know, be afraid, be very afraid, you know, is to just look at, okay, what is motivating those thoughts? And if we can bring those thoughts onto the altar of the mind with the Holy Spirit and say, okay, let's look at this together, and together we hold the lamp that will dispel the darkness. And the darkness has nothing to do with what happens or doesn't happen. It has to do with which thought system we're looking at it with. And so if we can remember when we have those panicky moments to just, you know, maybe take a deep breath or just inwardly just remember to think, what is the real source of my peace? And the real source of our peace is always a decision to shift our identity to the self that couldn't possibly change, that we all are. And that can, and sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, and it kind of depends on the script that we have, result in freeing up the mind to say, oh, well, gee, I could, you know, do this thing in the world or that thing in the world. And sometimes that results in things that work in that kind of ties into, you know, we could spend a whole hour talking about the development of trust, you know, of choosing what's valuable and what's valueless kind of thing. We just read that in one of our study groups this week. And that the six stages in the development of trust, that how that all gets into the idea that we don't really know what's valuable and what's valueless, because we're so identified with the processes and the circumstances in the world that we ascribe meaning and value to, that we think that having a specific job or not having a specific job or you know, being in a certain financial or biological or psychological or social, you know, status is some are better than others, you know.
Yeah.
That whole thing, realm of thinking, if we can just catch it when we start making that investment and, you know, drag it out onto the altar with the Close Encounters light coming down from the spaceship in our mind with the Holy Spirit saying, okay, let's beam the heck out of this. Because that's really the reality, is that light is there all the time. We just have to move those thoughts onto the altar where that light is shining so brightly, and they disappear. It doesn't mean that we don't take action. It doesn't mean that we, you know, you don't dust off your resume or you know, call around and network with friends and say, hey, here's what I love to do, and here's what my husband loves to do, or, you know, whatever the circumstance might be, and say, hey, do you know anybody that, you know, could put our talents to use, or just, you know, maybe go into a deeper state where something comes to mind. It's like, oh my gosh, I've always loved to do this. And you just find yourself moving into those realms where something, you know, happens, or maybe it doesn't happen, but to not ascribe meaning to the circumstances and forgive yourself when you do, you know?
Exactly. And that's it. It's, you know, these thoughts do not mean anything. Nothing I see here means anything.
Yeah.
Lesson one and lesson two, you know, if just do that, and it really, you know, when you see the truth of it, it does make you laugh.
It does.
There's no need.
The course always leads us away from fear and into freedom, doesn't it?
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, well, it looks like our time is up, Bruce. Hey, we made it. Kind of. We're a little over, but not really. And
can I put a quick plug in for several events that are happening? I actually just learned of one. There's a virtual summit that let's see if I can find the link here real quick. That is happening. That anyway, I'll have to send it to you and you can post it. But it's several course teachers that you'll be familiar with that are doing a free virtual summit on the course that's happening starting Monday, I think it is, for several days. And that'll be kind of fun to listen in on and participate. And then there's a couple of the things happening in Colorado. Lynn Corona and Tim Wise are doing a retreat in the Colorado Springs area that's happening in May, and then in Estes Park in June, where I'll be, along with several other people, including Gary Renard, Cindy Laura Renard, and David Hoffmeister, and a bunch of other folks that you're probably familiar with, is the Weekend of Freedom Retreat, and you can go to weekendoffreedomretreat.org or .com and register there if you're interested, and I think it's going to be a blast. And then Lynn and I are going to be, and probably a bunch of you listening maybe, are going to be in Las Vegas in a couple weekends at the conference there. So lots of course things going on in terms of virtual and seemingly not virtual events for course students to come together in different ways on. So I try to post all that kind of stuff on ACIM blog. So anyway, thank you again, Lynn. It's always a pleasure, and looking forward to our next conversation.
Outstanding. Yeah, me too. And now I'm going to go find some chocolate. Just kidding.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, be mindful on our little conveyor belt episodes, huh? Right?
That's right. So we will talk to you next week, Bruce. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today in the House of the Rising Sun.
Indeed. Thanks all.
Bye-bye.